So this morning's workshop, finding meaning and purpose in your life and as a family. What I want to talk about today is recovery from a broader perspective. Often when we bump into individuals for the first time, when guys are walking through the front door, there's been a lot of craziness, a lot of chaos, a lot of insanity, a lot of pain associated with the use of drugs or alcohol. And the focus really becomes around drugs and alcohol, around stopping using, around changing using behaviors. It really focuses around that. And guys walk through the front door often with the mistaken impression that they're here to learn to no longer use. And it might seem a little strange for an addictions counselor to talk about guys walking through the front door of an addiction treatment center with the mistaken impression that we're about not using. But really, that's our focus. To set the goal of not using, to make life at and after MRTC about not using, is really limited. I'm going to do a demonstration for you. I'm going to demonstrate somebody who leaves treatment after 35 days and doesn't use. This is me not using. This is me clean and sober. Day 36. Still not using. Day 37. Day 38. Day 41. By day 53, what do you predict? Yeah. If your recovery doesn't bring you more joy, if your recovery doesn't bring you more contentment, if your recovery doesn't make your life feel more full, if your recovery doesn't make you feel more engaged with the world than your addiction did, what do you predict? Our guys don't come here to get clean and sober. Our guys come here to get happy. Our guys come here to live a life of contentment and connection. And the reason we exist and the reason we focus so much on drugs and alcohol is quite simply that for the men we serve, these are men who have tried pretty much every way possible to have healthy, happy, functional, contented lives and use drugs and alcohol. What they end up discovering is, for our guys, that doesn't work. There's a lot of people out there that can have a glass of wine and have a life of contentment. Our guys don't tend to be those guys. There are people out there that can use methamphetamine recreationally and continue to live healthy, happy, functional lives. Get up and go to work. Have relationships. There are very few of those, methamphetamine. For every 100 guys who try to join that club, maybe 2 pull it off, and the other 98, see you soon. But it's the reality. For our guys, however, our guys are the guys who have tried to maintain a relationship to substances and found that that relationship precludes them from having a life worth living. A life that just isn't torturously painful. A former counselor of ours, Jeff Thompson, wrote a beautiful book. And in the beginning of his book is about, basically it's about finding meaning and purpose in recovery. And the beginning of his book, in the foreword, the point is made that's just beautiful, that that the goal of good addiction treatment should never be about the cessation of substance use. That's not a very good goal. So you quit using. So freaking what? That's your life, sitting in that chair. So what? The goal of good addiction treatment should never be the cessation of substance use. But changes in substance use should be a natural outcome of good treatment. In other words, if we work with our guys to uncover a life that brings them happiness and contentment and connection, odds are pretty good that if they're living that, they've stopped using. The cessation of drug and alcohol use is not an end in and of itself. It is a means to an end, and that end is a life well lived. And that's what this is about. This is about a life well lived. That's what I want to talk to you about today. Our model of wellness. Before I get there, everything in life comes with paperwork. This is no exception. If I get our clients to sign in with your first name, last initial, and room number, if you've got a visitor with you today, their first name and relationship to you, if you're alumni just visiting the center, just your first name and the fact that your alumni are visiting, just helps me keep track of who's in the room. So our model of recovery, our model of wellness, starts from a recognition that the vast majority of our guys found their way into addiction, not entirely by choice. How many of you guys in this room can remember back in your grade 5, you know, what I want to do when I grow up presentation? You know, Billy said he wanted to be a doctor, and Sally said she wanted to be a lawyer, and you got up there and read, you know, when I grow up, I want to be a drug addict? Anybody? Anybody do a career change midlife, come home from work one day and say, honey, the career of accountancy lacks something called bling. I think I'm going to get into the using and dealing community. It's time for a change. Anybody leave accountancy to become a drug addict? No, eh? Now, people don't choose to end up in addiction. People just use. They use drugs or they use alcohol. For many of our clients, it all started once upon a time when you and your buddies were hanging around. You're 15, being stupid, doing whatever. It was okay. And you started to party together, and you woke up one day at 35 and realized one by one, they met people, got jobs, finished school, bought houses, had cars, had kids, mortgages, and you were still partying. For the vast majority of our guys, there's all kinds of pathways to start using. And very quickly, when our guys started down that path, they found that drugs and alcohol served a purpose. Often it filled in a hole. And often the hole that it filled in was created through using. Something got out of whack. Something got painful. Something got difficult. The guys struggled in some way. And drugs and alcohol were a bad coping mechanism, but a coping mechanism nonetheless. And so really, our model of wellness looks at the areas in people's lives that things can start to go sideways in. The areas that went sideways that people invited substance use in to manage. Because one way to deal with it is just to take away the substance use, but then what? Geez, my life hurts in an unmanageable, intolerable way, so I use drugs. And now I think I'll stop using drugs. What am I left with? A life of unmanageable suffering. I don't think so. So why don't we forget about the drugs for a moment? Why don't we go to whatever the suffering is, whatever the area of wellness is, whatever the area that people are out of balance happens to be? Why don't we go fix that? Because if it no longer hurts, odds are pretty good that I can pretty easily walk away from the substance. Our model of wellness. Well, our model of wellness comes in a number of areas. The wellness wheel poster is up on the thing there, it's hard for everyone to see, so I'll draw it on the board here and show you all why I went to counseling school and not art school. So the first area is the emotional. Many of our guys find their way into substance use through emotional issues, emotional struggles, anxiety, depression, all sorts of hurt, anger, disappointment, all sorts of emotional thrusts that they find they can cope with substance use. I can remember working in an outpatient clinic very early in my career. I had just started, was doing my practicum, and I had a counselor, or had a client, sorry, making an appointment with me. He didn't show up. Made a follow-up appointment. He didn't show up. The third appointment, he was about 25 minutes late. I was getting ready to give up on him, and he walked through the front door drunk. So we went and we sat down and we talked. And what had happened was, this is a guy who was living in a lot of emotional pain, a guy who was living in a lot of anxiety. And he decided that something needed to be different in his life. So he made an appointment at his local addiction clinic. And he walked out his front door, and he almost made it to the bus stop, and he got so overwhelmed, so freaked out. He had a panic attack, basically, and he turned around and ran back inside his house, missed the appointment. The second week, he got on the bus and got about two-thirds of the way there, and he freaked out, had a panic attack, got off the bus and literally ran home, ran about a mile and a half home, locked himself up in his house. The third week, he made it almost to the addiction clinic, almost, and he started to freak out again. The anxiety started to become overwhelming. And he got off the bus, and he was about to run home, and he noticed a liquor store, and he thought, you know what? I got to go. And so he walked into the liquor store, bought a six-pack of beer, pounded them back. And when the anxiety subsided enough, he walked through the front door and said, I'm screwed. Help me. And so one of the things that became very evident to me is that you really need to look at the underlying emotional issues around your addiction. He said, I know, I have an anxiety counselor. And I said, what did your anxiety counselor say to you? She said to me, she's not going to treat me until I stop drinking. Well, why do you drink? Because I can't leave the house unless I'm loaded. What a bind. There's all kinds of paths into addiction or all kinds of paths into problematic substance use that start in issues of emotion. Anger, resentment, anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress kind of issues. The physical. And many of these things are kind of tied together in a wheel because they also impact on each other. The physical and the emotional, incredibly tied. One of the best things somebody can do for depression is aerobic exercise, oxygenate the brain. That physical kind of stuff impacts on emotion. The emotional stuff impacts on the physical, etc., etc. The physical roots of addiction. All kinds of ways in which physically people get caught in addiction. Industrial accidents are a classic one. It's interesting that on the east coast of Canada, heroin is almost impossible to find. Pretty much doesn't exist in Newfoundland. Can't find heroin. And the reason you can't find heroin in Newfoundland is nobody would ever bother to import it. Because there are so many industrial accidents, there's so much opiate medication floating around the rock that you don't need to import heroin. You just phone a buddy, he's probably got a medicine cabinet full of pills for you. Guys in Newfoundland, they're addicted to oxycosid, oxycodone, Dilaudid, morphine, you name it. The physical roots of addiction. We find guys, for instance, who have very active lives, who find lives through very active ways, meaning and purpose. And we've seen any number of ex-athletes come through MRTC. Life has meaning. They have balance. They're in a groove. Everything's going okay. They get hurt. They can't do their kind of activities. Addiction enters. Among the elderly, it's pretty classic as you see people age and they start to live alone. And you start to see people's mobility get restricted through some of the ailments that are happening, people losing licenses. Addiction among the elderly is unbelievably prevalent, with prescription medication and alcohol addiction quite high. Assisted living homes, retirement homes, the number of dial-a-bottle runs to these places are astronomical. Can't get out to get engaged in a life that's meaningful. Can't get out and get engaged in the world. But I can have somebody bring me a bottle and I don't care about it. Occupational. Especially for men, this is a big one. There are industries that seem to be classic at inviting addiction. A lot of the primary industries, especially industries where guys head out for a while, work completely out of balance. You know, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week in camp, do that for 6 weeks, and then I come back to town with $23,000 cash in my pocket, looking to blow off some steam. I spent some time up in Fort St. John, first time I'd ever been in that town. That town is classic for this. It's surrounded by all kinds of primary industry, guys out in the bush, out in the oil patches, and they come back in. And the town just goes nuts. And there's got to be more Harley-Davidsons and Ford pickup trucks sold in that town in the time guys coming off the patch than anywhere else on the planet. Come back 3 weeks later, and you've got the best scrapyards on the planet. There are more broken Harley-Davidsons with no miles on them and broken Ford pickup trucks in Fort St. John than anywhere I've ever seen. Again, that occupational piece. The other thing we see, though, is especially as men, there seems to be this way in which men find a lot of meaning and a lot of identity in occupation. There are a lot of ways in which people can feel out of sync or in occupations that don't engage them. There are a lot of guys I work with who find substance, it's not sort of the context of work that encourages substance use, like the trades. It's more just, you know what, I'm bored out of my skull. And I can't cope with my job. But I find when I smoke a joint, it's not too bad. When I find I have a couple of beers at lunch, it's not too bad. I find if I do a little bit of crack cocaine in the bathroom, I can make it through a day. And there are a lot of guys who really end up being out of balance in the occupational and addiction coming in. Thinking. Like I say, I've never been to art school. The size of the pie piece is in no way related to their importance, and it's entirely a function of my lack of spatial ability. Thinking. A lot of what would be talked about in the program is stinking thinking. Negative self-talk. Low self-esteem. Depression, again, we talk about in the emotional side, but we can talk about depression as a thought disturbance, a thought disorder as well. See, depression in terms of the way in which we think, these problematic thoughts we have about ourselves that can really invite in addiction. A lot of men, kind of like the anxiety disorder example, there are a lot of guys who will use drugs or alcohol to quiet their minds. I go to bed at night, my mind races, and I hate what's in there, but you know, I smoke a couple of joints, and all of a sudden it goes quiet, and I can slip off to sleep. I drink a six-pack of beer, and all of a sudden, I'm calm, I'm relaxed, and it's okay. The thinking piece, again, really ties into a lot of the stuff, but at its core, it's really just problematic thoughts, problematic patterns of thinking, attitudes around substances that can really invite in problems. And, of course, the final piece is social. Loneliness, isolation, disconnection. There are a lot of people who manage their social lives around substances or manage their lack of social connection around substance use. One of the great things about being an addict, one of the benefits of addiction, and people often look at me a little strange when I talk about the benefits of addiction, but there really are. There really are many things that that substance use has brought to the lives of our guys. And it's important to recognize the things, the positive things it's brought, because if you want to quit substances, you've got to replace those things. But one of the benefits of being an addict is that's a club you can belong to anywhere on the planet. Drop one of our guys on any continent, in any strange town. You don't even need to speak the language. Got a bit of money in your pocket? You can find what you're looking for. And once you found what you're looking for, you got friends until it runs out. For many of our guys, and we see this in communities where people are stuck, like the downtown East Side, is a really interesting place. There's a tremendous sense of community down there. There's a tremendous community and set of social orders and set of social structures. And this belief that people belong there or don't, and this capacity of people, when they find themselves living down there, to look out for each other and connect to each other and support each other. It's astounding. On the surface, it's a pretty scary place, but get inside that kind of culture, and you find something quite different down there. Although, not without its edges, because addiction brings in craziness. But that social piece, the loneliness, the isolation, the disconnection. Isolation is addiction's best friend. Addiction thrives in isolation. It's kind of like, you know, mildew grows when you have moisture, and isolation breeds addiction. At the core of it, though, is the spiritual piece. And on the wellness wheel, the wellness wheel is not an MRTC invention by any means. If there's kind of anything that MRTC has done that might be a little bit of a twist, it's moving the spiritual to the center, to make it kind of the hub around which everything else turns, because the spiritual is probably the most important aspect of all. And by spiritual, what we're really talking about is a reason to clean up in the first place. One question I have for every guy that walks through the front door is, so why clean up? Why bother? Why change when staying exactly the same is a perfectly viable option that would require a lot less work? Why change? Why bother? Why quit? Why? That spiritual piece, that's at the crux, we believe, of addiction treatment. And now, a lot of addiction treatment, a lot of the mainstream cultural stuff around addiction is rooted in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, which are traditions founded by white Christian men. And so there's an awful lot of addiction and recovery stuff that is rooted in Christian philosophy. And often if you're in an addiction center talking about spirituality, people think you're talking about Christianity, you're talking about Jesus, or you're talking about God, or God as we have come to know him or her. The spirituality we talk about at MRTC is a little broader than that. Certainly, if you have embraced Jesus as your Savior, then you have some spiritual principles, a guidebook to live by. If you happen to be Jewish, you have some spiritual principles, a guideline to live by. If you happen to be Muslim, if you happen to be Buddhist, if you happen to be Taoist, each one of these spiritual philosophies provides you with a guidebook, a rule book. It helps you answer the question, why bother? Because really, that's the crux. The rallying cry to relapse for the vast majority of guys I work with is, to heck with it. Usually expressed a little more edgy and a little more colorfully. To heck with it. Cleaning up's hard. Why bother? What the hell am I doing this for? I got 6 months sober. My life's in the toilet. Why bother? To heck with it. Gone. Why am I doing this? Why am I doing any of this? What does it matter? Why do I matter? Well, again, if you have a spiritual principle that's laid out for you, if you have a guidebook, you may have 10 commandments and a bunch of other things that tell you, why bother? Because you got a mission. You were put here for a reason. Why get out of bed today? Well, I'll tell you why to get out of bed today. And at the end of today, was today a day well lived? Well, I don't know. Let's check the rule book. Well, you didn't break any of 1 through 10. And you did some good deeds and you turned the other cheek, I'd call it a good day. Sleep well. If you're connected to a spiritual tradition, this piece of understanding around why bother becomes pretty easy to understand. The way I like to look at it, one of the counselors here, Mark, will talk about one of the truths that he has to be confronted with is the fact that he, in his chest is a heart that beats. He was born with a beating heart. And that heart will beat a finite number of times throughout his life. The number of heartbeats is beyond his capacity to count. But it won't beat forever. It will beat a number of times, and he doesn't know how many. And then it will stop one day and never beat again. And in recognition of that, he comes to appreciate the fact that every one of his heartbeats is important. Every one of his heartbeats is sacred. And the question he then asks himself is, as I'm spending these heartbeats that I'm never going to get back, I have a finite pool of heartbeats. I've spent a couple thousand of them so far while talking to you. I now need to ask myself the question, did I spend them well? Or did I spend them poorly? Did I spend them in a way that's meaningful? Or did I just allow them to go by in a way that simply doesn't matter? And that's the peace, the spiritual peace. At the end of my days, when my heart beats in my chest for the last time, when I look back at how I spent them, will I have a sense of contentment and comfort knowing that I've done them well, that I've honored and respected them, and use them wisely? Or as my heart is coming to beat for the last time, will I panic, thinking of all the ways in which I haven't lived, all the things in which I never did? How do I know if I'm spending my heartbeats wisely? Well, again, if I happen to belong to a particular religion, it will tell me at the end of the day I have a rule book for whether I live well. But even in the absence of that, the spirituality we talk about at MRTC is a spirituality that embraces even atheists. An atheist spirituality seems kind of strange to say. But what that really means is, in the absence of anyone else having a rule book, in the absence of believing there's anything beyond the heartbeats while I'm standing on this planet, I have to come up with this felt sense of, have I spent them wisely or not? Have I wasted them or not? And one of the things that we really believe is that if you live your life spending them well, it tends to be a life well lived. And it's up to each and every one of us to decide whether or not we live them well. Whether it happens to be deciding through taking on a particular spiritual faith, or whether it happens through coming up with your own sense of spirituality. But coming to build a life of wellness, looking at each of those areas, looking at each of those areas in balance, is the key to recovery. It's the key to recovery because if you do it and do it well, you come up with a life so worth living that drugs and alcohol take their rightful place. They become irrelevant. You know? It's kind of like you hear about the guy who continues to complain about his ex and talk about how over her he is. I hate her. I can't stand her. I'm so over her. I'm so done with her. And that's all he's talked about for the last 3 weeks. Is he done? No. The guy who's done with her goes, who? Oh, yeah, I used to date her. It's that kind of way with drugs and alcohol. When you're living the beautiful life, the life in recovery, the life that you were supposed to live, drugs and alcohol take care of itself. I mean, imagine for a moment a life where emotionally everything was fine. No depression, no anxiety. Anger was an emotion that came on when appropriate. It didn't drive your behavior, it just came into your life. You're able to express it in a healthy way, and it left. You're able to feel joy, able to feel connection, able to feel sorrow without running from it, without panicking. A life where your physical health was solid. I mean, yeah, you might not be cut like, say, Arnie or me, but physically you're able to do the things you need to do in the world. You're okay. No chronic pain, no underlying issues that you can't manage. A world where occupationally you're doing something that you feel matters to you in some way. It might matter directly to you. It might be the kind of occupation that brings you passion, brings you meaning or purpose. Or you know what? You're going to be putting bolts on nuts, and it's fine because what it really does is frees you up to go home and look after the people that are important to you. It might not even be through work. It might be through volunteering. It really, in the occupational, is about some sense of belonging, some sense of connection. Feeling like I'm doing something that is related to something that matters. Get up in the morning and look forward to going and being part of something. And at the end of the day, feel like, yeah, there is an importance in doing that. Imagine a life where your thinking is clear. No negative self-talk, no low self-esteem issues, no... You don't go through the day going, oh, I'm a loser, what a stick. None of that. Just free and clear. Somewhat objective capacity to see the world as it is. Imagine a life where your social life is dialed in. It might not mean, you know, you're married with the Brady Bunch thing going on. It could be single and just connected. But the important thing is that there are people in the world that you know you can count on, you can rely on, you can lean on, who will be there for you. And you know that there are people in the world who rely on you. You feel connected. You feel part of that sense of importance. And at the core of all of it, this fundamental spiritual connection, this sense of meaning and purpose, this you wake up in the morning and you know that there's a reason to get out of bed and get engaged in today. I have to get out of bed today because I have a place on the planet. It's important. There are things on this planet that need me to do them. And it's important. And at the end of the day, when you go to bed, you can put your head on the pillow and know that today was a day well spent. Today was a day I can look back on and feel at peace about. No regret. No sense of wasting. Imagine. Imagine a world where you have that balance. All of that's dialed in. A vision of a life that's delicious, that's exciting. A life where you feel emotionally okay and physically okay, and you're working and you're part of, and your head's clear and you're connected. And there's meaning and purpose and a vision, something to strive for, to move toward. Imagine that life. And imagine that every decision you made from here on in, no matter what it was, a decision about a different job, a decision about where to go for dinner, a decision about an activity, a decision about whether or not to call in sick, a decision about whether or not to use crack cocaine. Every decision you made was simply asking yourself, if I do what I'm about to do, does it move me closer to or further away from my vision of a life well lived? And if every decision you made from here on out simply moved you one step closer to a life you were passionate about, one step closer to a life you found delicious, exciting, fulfilling, every decision you made from here on out moved you one step closer to the light, what possible room would there be in your life for drugs or alcohol? What are the odds that you could get loaded if you continued to make every decision about moving toward the light? That's our model of wellness. And I got to tell you, our model of wellness could be applied to substance addiction, to food addiction, to just generally being miserable on the planet. You could shut down tomorrow as an addiction treatment center and reopen simply as a wellness center. But the only thing we'd need to do is take the word drugs and alcohol off our pamphlets and probably recruit more clients from Kitsilano. It's about living and living well. The other important thing is recognize that it's a wheel, believe it or not. And the wheel is important because understand it's about balance. I got to tell you, there's a lot of guys who walk out of here going, Wes, hey, this treatment has been great. I feel on top of the world. Thanks very much. I got it all figured out. I know what I got to do, man. That's right on. Yeah, I figure, you know, idle time is just deadly. So I'm going to keep myself busy. I'm going to keep myself so busy. I got to train. I got this opportunity to work. I can work 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to work and I'm going to work 14 hours. And I'm going to come home. I'll be so bagged that I'll just fall asleep, wake up the next morning, do the same thing. Sunday, I'll like wash my shorts and buy some groceries and sleep in and get ready to do it again. You sure about that? Oh, yeah, well, it's my plan. Good luck with that. Come see me in 6 months. Maybe 8 at the most. Because what happens? Guy puts his energy into the occupational and really expands that. And the other areas of his life kind of flatten. And all of a sudden, that's what he's trying to ride through the world on. That doesn't roll so well. As the occupational expands and everything else shrinks, that doesn't roll smooth. What we tend to find when guys take on that plan is 6 months later, they're physically burnt out. Occupationally, they're doing great. Thinking, probably caught in their head a little bit. Social life, completely disconnected. Haven't seen anyone, haven't connected with anyone, not working their program. Emotionally, they're bored. They're lonely. They're disconnected. Spiritually, it got me more to life than just getting up and going through the grind. But occupationally, it's a bump. And what we find is in about 6 to 8 months, typically, buddy wakes up one day, lonely, disconnected, bored, depressed, burnt out, and with $27,000 in the bank. Because he's worked a lot of overtime and hasn't had time to spend it. And what do you predict? Yeah. Time and again, about 6 to 8 months. And so we have another conversation about the wellness wheel is next time through treatment. Overdeveloping any one area. Or leaving a flat spot in any one area. You know? Leaving out the social. That doesn't roll very well either. It's really about building a life and building a life in balance. It's about attending to the various areas of wellness. Because if you leave any area out, it becomes a vulnerability. You can see the way in which addiction can find its way in people's lives as a tool to cope with areas of the life that isn't working. Keep your life running in balance. Keep it running smooth. We like your chances. Overdevelop or underdevelop an area, things can get weird in a hurry. I want to expand what I'm talking about a little bit to talk about this finding purpose, finding meaning, moving a little bit beyond what I've been talking about. In other workshops, I talk about patterns people get into, and I'm just going to touch on it very briefly here, but just to say that for many people who come to MRTC, prior to coming to MRTC, they've been caught in these patterns, their relationships, their connections, the way in which they are with other people. It seems like the only time we're together, the only time we're connected, is when we're bonding in crisis. Life is just one crisis. And if you want to be part of my life, you kind of got to get in the game. Bonding in negativity. It's like the only time we ever get together, we talk about how dark things are. Bonding in discussions about using or not using. It's astounding. But communication in families really shrinks when addiction enters until... seems like the only thing we talk about is he loaded or isn't he loaded? And after treatment, that's all we talk about as well. It's amazing that how communication shrinks. In my experience, in many of the families I work with, it's the only question they have. Well, there's three questions that most families start asking when addiction really sets in. Only three questions that ever get asked. Is he loaded? Was he loaded? Or is he about to get loaded? Once upon a time in our family, we talked about all kinds of stuff, and now that's all we ever talk about. Is he loaded? Was he loaded? Is he about to get loaded? Now, we have all kinds of ways of doing it to make it look like we're having conversation. For instance, how are you, Sean? Is he loaded? So, it was payday yesterday, wasn't it? Was he loaded? It's payday next Friday for you. Is he about to get loaded? So you saw your buddy Bob. How's Bob? Bob's still in the program? He's still doing well? Because you were out all night with him. And it's not just to our clients. Once upon a time, Mom used to phone your sister and say, "Hi, honey, how are you? How's work? How's your husband? How's the kids?" And now it's, "Hi, honey, it's Mom. Have you seen Bob? Well, how did he look?" And this wasn't how it was supposed to be. In marriages, you know, I'll ask somebody's wife, "How are you?" She'll look at him. If he's sober, "We're doing well. We're having a good week." "No, how are you?" "I don't get it. I don't get it. How am I? Oh. I'm fine." War stories. That's the final piece. It shrinks. Families. Meaning. Purpose. I mean, it's not once upon a time what we signed up for. It's often where we get to. And there's a tendency not only for families to shrink around this using, not using dimension, but for guys themselves. And obviously, you know, I talk in generalities a lot because what I really do is take a very typical experience. This may apply very well to a lot of our guys, might apply very well to everyone in this room. Might be guys who don't fit this quite so well, but bear with me. There's a real tendency for many of our guys to take recovery on in a bit of a narcissistic way, in a bit of a selfish way, in a bit of an egocentric way. There's a bit of a tendency for our guys really to focus on their recovery. Recovery coming before everything else. My sobriety coming before everything else. And for family members to do the same thing. I talked to, you know, a guy's mom, and I say, so when's the last time you took a vacation? She said, are you kidding? My son's been in addiction for 3 years. Yeah, but I don't get why you're not going to Florida. You've been using with him? No. Well, then what's holding you back? It's not like he's asking you to pack a kilo of Coke back with you. I mean, go, take a trip. But, you know, when's the last time you've been to the gym and leave him unsupervised? And so in addiction, things really get focused around the guy. I mean, the thing about addiction becomes a very narcissistic endeavor. Guys really, they become focused on meeting the needs of their drug of choice. And the unfortunate experience is for many guys when they're active in their addiction, these areas of the wellness wheel are things that they do with the time they have left over after taking care of the needs of their drug of choice. And especially with some of the harder drugs. If I don't use, if I don't maintain, I'm going to be sick. So I got to maintain. I got to use. I got to manage my experience. I got to do certain things. So family, yeah, family's what I do with the energy I have left over after I've met the needs of my addiction. Work, yeah, absolutely. Work, I'm there. On Tuesday, maybe Wednesday. I think I can get away with it until Wednesday. But absolutely come Wednesday, I have to be at work. Because if I'm not at work, I won't have a paycheck for 10 days after that when I need to get loaded again. It's like life becomes organized around the drug of choice. That's if you read the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, its definition of addiction really talks about addiction only being diagnosable when the substance used takes a central point in someone's life. It's kind of the central piece and everything else flows around it. Now, one of the things that's been thrown around is this idea that perhaps as a result of how central addiction's been, guys get really used to sort of meeting their own needs first. Families get really used to trying to manage the guy first. I got to take care of my husband and then I'll worry about myself. I got to take care of my son and then I'll think about my vacation. Because everybody gets focused around addiction, when people come into recovery, everything seems to be focused around the person in recovery first and foremost. Families walk on eggshells. It's like, I hope the Canucks start winning. Because if they keep losing, he might get loaded. I don't think he could take another year of them missing the playoffs. People walk on eggshells. The tendency, and I can't blame anyone for this, is really to put recovery first and foremost. And I hear things like, and this is one of the things, I have missions. One of my missions is to stamp out the following. Recovery is a selfish business. You got to look after yourself first. Because if you don't look after yourself, you're no good to anyone else anyway. I got to look after me. I got to push them aside. I can't look after you. I got to look after me first. Recovery really is a selfish process. One of my missions is to stamp that out. Let me put this on hold and tell you a couple of stories. There was a couple, our former clinical manager, Kathy Patterson Sterling, a couple that she worked with, did some family sessions with, and he gratituded in July. Finished program, did a really good program, was really gung-ho in his recovery, was really working his recovery well, had done some good work before he came to MRTC and was doing some really good work after. And it was one of those days, one of those beautiful Vancouver days, one of those days that almost makes you understand our real estate prices. Or at least what our real estate prices used to be. And it was like 28 degrees. Not a cloud in the sky. It had rained a couple days before, so the air was crystal clear. The North Shore Mountains were just razor sharp. You could, like, count snowflakes on them. The air was so clear and blue. And he's down at, like, Kitts Beach or Jericho Beach. And it's 28 degrees, the sun is warm, but there's that cool, fresh, salty breeze coming in off the ocean, just keeping him at a perfect temperature. And he and the woman he loves are walking down the beach hand in hand. And this is like the first time in months he's been outdoors during daylight hours. And here he is, walking down the beach hand in hand with the woman he loves. Their shoes are off, and the sand is warm, squishing through their toes, and they're just walking down the beach. And they got one of these big, dumb dogs, a lab or a retriever or something, and walking down the beach, and he picks up this stick, and he fires the stick into the water, and the dog goes bounding out into the water, and grabs the stick, and comes swimming back in, drops the stick, and shakes. The spray of water goes up into that beautiful air, refracting the light. It's one of those moments, one of those perfect moments. And he picks up the stick and he fires it into the water. The dog comes bounding out. He picks up the stick and he fires it into the water. And the dog comes bounding out. They walk hand in hand, talking about nothing. And the dog comes bounding out. And he picks up the stick and he looks at his partner, the woman he loves. And he says, you know, this is just like in addiction. In addiction, she goes, stop, time out. Why does it always come back to addiction? And why does it always come back to recovery? Why, 24/7, no matter what we're doing in our life, are we bringing it back to addiction and recovery? Honey, why can't it just be about you and me and a stick and a dog on a perfect day? This moment, this thing that we're doing, this is not like recovery. This is not about recovery. This is the reward we get because you're in recovery. This is the prize. This is the gift. Why do we want to be stepping out of the reward and back into the work? Don't get me wrong. You need your program. You need your meetings. I support you 100%. But right here, right now, you're safe. Because it's just you and me. And a stick and a dog. And it doesn't need to be any more than that. What I described in terms of the wellness wheel, in terms of moving toward the light, that was one of the perfect moments. Doesn't need to be any more than that. The other story I have is a little bit darker. Guy came through MRTC, did a great program. Fabulous program. Left MRTC, continued to work his program post-treatment. Attended meetings, got a sponsor. Took his 1-year cake, took on sponsees, did service work. Got involved in all sorts of recreational activities, disconnected from his friends and built his life around the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. Joined baseball teams. Went to roundups. Really engaged and immersed himself in a recovery program. About 3 years post-treatment, came home one day. Living the dream. 3 years, plus a bit, clean and sober. Working the program. Admired and respected in the recovery community. Doing everything anyone had ever asked him to do. Living the dream. Came home from work. And his wife was there. She had packed. Her stuff, the kids' stuff, the kids, they were gone. She just stuck around to say goodbye. And he was baffled. And he was angry. He just couldn't get, you're leaving me? But I'm clean and sober. I got 3 years. And he could not understand that maybe to sustain the life he wanted took something more than just 3 years clean and sober. And what she said to him is, you know, honey, once upon a time, you and I got together. And we put our hands together and we looked down at a world in front of us. We had hopes and dreams and aspirations of a beautiful life. We had goals. We had thoughts of where we could end up walking through the world together, you and I, that we couldn't get to alone. And we started our journey, and honey, it was beautiful. And then things got a little weird. And the issues around your substances showed up, and I started to get really panicky. And I started to lose sight of the hopes and dreams and aspirations we had. I started to think maybe one day we wouldn't get to where we wanted to go. And just as I was losing hope, you came home and told me you were going to treatment. And I thought, wow. Maybe. Just maybe. And so I hung in there and you went to treatment. And honey, I was so proud of you. And you finished that program and you came home and you're working your aftercare. I was so proud of you. And I supported you. And you told me you needed to go to meetings. You went to meetings. You'd come home from work. I'd have dinner on the table. You'd eat dinner. You'd go out to meeting. Come home. We'd have a few minutes together. Bed. Work. On the weekend, service work. Roundups. Baseball. And for the first year of recovery, I just hung back and let you work your program. But by the end of the first year, I started to talk to you. And I started to tell you, you know what? I need more. But I was really trapped because you said, hey, I got to work my program here. If I don't work my program, I could end up getting loaded. And if I'm loaded, I'm no good to any of us. Yeah, I mean, what she was left with was I could no more ask you to not work your program than I could ask a cancer patient to stop going to chemotherapy appointments. I couldn't say to you, honey, don't go to chemo today. Spend the day with me and the kids. So you went to meetings. 4, 5, 6, 7 days a week. And I was proud of you, but I was growing more and more lonely. And I talked to you, and I tried to go to meetings with you, and I tried to engage in these events with you, but we never really could get there. And then there were the kids, and they missed you. And so I talked to you more and more, and I waited for you. I waited for you to put it together, and I waited for the day where you would be recovered and we could move forward in life. And I just kept becoming more and more lonely and kept thinking more and more about asking you to stop doing some of the things that are keeping you sober, that are keeping you alive. And I realized that I couldn't do that. And so I guess once upon a time I thought I lost you to addiction. And then I thought I was going to get you back, and now I've come to realize that no, I've lost you to addiction, to recovery, to I don't know. All I know is that I love you. I want the best for you. But I can't continue to live getting 15 minutes of you a night. I can't continue to live getting one weekend out of four. It's not enough. I'm leaving. And he felt betrayed. He felt betrayed by her. Most importantly, he felt betrayed by recovery. How is it possible that I could do all the things I was supposed to do, and this is the reward? This is what recovery gives me? For 3 years of doing all the right things? Yeah. Everything in balance. If it's true that's the program he must work, then his recovery has sentenced him to a doomed marriage. Because she could no longer cash in her happiness, her hopes of walking through the world with another human being and waiting for him to recover. The temptation is that recovery is a selfish process. The temptation is that I got to get myself better before I can connect to the world, before I can give back. But how long? I'm pretty sure by the time you have 28 years clean, you're probably good to go. You can probably back off. You can probably get in the game. At year 28, I'm pretty sure you can get in the game. Day one after treatment, you might not be ready to fully embrace the game. So here's the thing. Somewhere between day one and year 28 is a point at which you can and need to get in the game. And I don't know when that point is. But it's there somewhere, and you've got to find that. The temptation is I got to get me all good. I got to be able to stand on my own two feet before I can move forward. But I got to tell you, that's one of the stronger structures around. Add a third, add a fourth, and you got a structure that can withstand anything. Drawn a different way. You might not be able to stand on your own, but if two people fall on each other in just the right way, you can hold yourselves up while you work it out. Anyone who believes recovery is a selfish business, after being in this treatment center where 60 men live in community, healing in community, growing in community, helping each other in community, if you still believe it's a selfish business, you haven't been paying attention to what seems to be at the heart of the kinds of changes that make a difference in men's lives here. This community works because 60 guys lean on each other. Reclaiming an identity. Family becomes defined by the patterns of addiction, as I've said. Reclaiming a family identity in recovery is critical. Who are you outside of your recovery program? What is family outside of your recovery program? Have you built in space for play? Space for having fun? It's something that's not talked about enough in treatment programs. Here at MRTC, the best programs that I put on are things like the Sober Bowl party in 2 weeks. For many of our men, it'll be the first time they've watched a Super Bowl and can remember the score the next day. Road hockey in the parking lots. Up until the point they drove my head into the concrete, it was one of my favorite activities around here with the guys. And I'll be back again, although probably with a helmet, WCP. How are you going to be emotionally available in the moment? That's the thing. Living that kind of recovery, that kind of recovery program about waiting until I'm all better so I can be there. No, how can you be there now, emotionally available in the moment? Able to walk down the beach with the stick and the dog and be there. Not here, not at a meeting, not in a group, but in the moment that's afforded to you by recovery. Sharing. And intimacy, the grand prize. Early on in counseling, I came across this, and I promised myself I would never, ever, ever write this down. Because it's the cheesiest, dumbest thing I ever saw. Intimacy. Written as, into me you see. First time I saw it, I thought, how corny, how cheesy. But you know what? I've been trying for years to come up with a better way to talk about it, and I can't. Into me you see. The capacity for two human beings to stand together in their own naked vulnerability. For another human being to see beyond the it's all good kind of exterior. To see my heart and mind and soul for what it truly is. And have me be okay. Okay being seen for who I am. And for me to be able to see in them. Not walking on eggshells around each other. Not leaving things aside. But two people holding hands just standing in their naked vulnerability. It is amazing. That's what happens in our groups. 10 strangers come together. And see beyond each other's public presentation. And come to appreciate that, you know what? I see you for who you are and I still love you. I still care about you. You're still a worthy, decent human being. And you know what? If you are and 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 you are, maybe I am too. How do you claim these things outside a recovery program? How do you build a family identity, an identity for yourself, for your family, for your support network, for your life, that includes recovery, not vice versa? Recovery is not an end. Recovery is not the goal. I got 3 years, I got 5 years, I got 10 years, I got 20 years, I'm dead. But I'm living well, I'm living well, I'm living well, I'm living well, I'm dead. I mean, the end point doesn't change for any of us. What we put between now and then does. I ask guys this all the time. Suppose I could offer you a treatment that was 100% guaranteed to make sure you never use drugs or alcohol again. Would you take it? Guys always say, yeah, absolutely. Most. A couple go, yeah, can I get back to you? But we can work with that. Then I say, oh, one small side effect. You won't ever be able to experience joy or contentment, but you'll be clean and sober. I have yet to have a single taker. No joy, no contentment, no happiness. I ain't taking your treatment. Because guys don't come here to get clean and sober. They come here to get joy, contentment, happiness. Life well lived. Recovery is not an end in and of itself. Addiction treatment, sobriety, is not an end in and of itself. It is the price of admission to the lives that you guys have waiting for you. The lives you deserve to live. So in summary, our program is about balance. It's about the ways in which, when areas of your life, one or more area of your life gets out of control, it's a wide open invitation to cope with substances. The vast majority of our guys don't end up, by the time they come into MRTC, using drugs or alcohol for the same reason they started. Guys often start innocently, or as coping with one thing, and they end up using to maintain the using, to maintain the misery of addiction. Or avoid it. But it tends to start with something getting out of whack. The temptation is to focus on fixing it and fixing it on your own. To get me better so I can get in the game. The encouragement is, get in the game. It'll get you better. Step into the life. It'll get you well. And it'll get you sober. As long as you keep moving toward the light. The intimacy, the connection, and the grand prize, those perfect moments, the capacity to experience those perfect moments, whatever they look like, your version of the stick and the dog. Next week, I'm going to be talking about rebuilding trust. Thanks for your attention. I'll see you then.